Welcome everyone to week 6 of Mindfulness Applied. So just to just some housekeeping, this is obviously the, as I mentioned before, this is the last lecture of this particular series. As I travel, please God, next week on Wednesday overseas for my daughter's wedding. However, what I am going to do is when I come back just before the end of the term, on the 30th of March, we'll just do a one-off before Pesach on the 30th of March titled Life-Changing Lessons from the Seder Plate. So that's 30th of March is a Thursday, same time, same place, just life-changing lessons from the Seder Plate. And then we'll take a break, obviously, over Pesach. And then the new series, just if you want to plan ahead, next term will start on the 27th of April. That's the new series next term. So today what I want to do is to just sum up and put it all together and just share some additional thoughts on the whole concept of mindfulness. So let's just do a quick review of last week. Last week we talked about strengthening the muscle. In other words, we said we talked about taking the tools and the characteristics that are necessary for the concept of mindfulness and strengthening them when things are going relatively well, not to wait till things are challenging, but when things are going relatively well. And we talked about those things like just practicing awareness on a regular day, practicing small things of not being judgmental, practicing patience, which is sometimes difficult, practicing the idea of non-striving, not having to always finish, but to be on a journey and just understand that the journey towards the end is as important. Acceptance, learning to accept, which is another hard one. Accept things the way they are, accept things that the expectations that we have might not be the real ones. The idea of trust, surrendering, giving up control, bitachon, trusting God, that also just, again, when things are a little bit out of routine, not when they're very challenging, to practice these ideas, and also the concept of self-worth. Because often the distracting thoughts that we have to do with the way we think other people are perceiving us, and that's why this idea of understanding our own self-worth often helps to be able to focus on the moment. And the theory we discussed last week was that when we go through a more challenging time, a time that is very distracting and full of negative thinking patterns and so on, then we can call on those strengths to be able to assist us. If they are strong muscles to begin with, and we've practiced them, then we can call on them to be able to combat those thoughts and engage in the various in the various strategies. Because those strong points, those strong tools that we have, that's really who we are. That's really our identity. Now, a few weeks ago, I mentioned, and I just want to develop it a little bit, I mentioned something that Miriam Adahan talks about, and that's HRB, which is the concept of healthy replacement beliefs. And the reason I bring it back now is because this concept, and I'll explain in a minute, is particularly relevant when we practice what we talked about last week. In other words, when we practice strengthening the muscles of those normal mindfulness tools, and then we're confronted with a challenging, distracting time, and we have these thoughts that are obsessing our mind and invading our whole thinking pattern, and we need to replace them or we need to push them away, we can use some of those, what she calls the healthy replacement beliefs, because they're there and they're stronger. For example, she talks about self-worth, and she says that a person needs to be able to practice those thought patterns and say to themselves, despite my negative patterns, I'm worthy as any person. I deserve love, joy, and respect. In other words, the idea of self-worth, or something like, despite my childish tendency to overvalue others' opinions, I can learn to take limited human opinions with a grain of salt. Again, that's only possible to think that way if we've strengthened the muscle of self-worth. Another one she says is like, even if a person's in fear or anxious about something, and then the thought that she suggests is, even if I feel scared of the future, I trust that God is always with me and will help me discover new coping skills. But again, that's not possible if we wait until a challenge happens. Only possible if in better times than in normal times we try and strengthen that concept of trust. Or even though I've had many disappointments, I can bear the discomforts of life with faith, humility, compassion, and patience. But again, you can only talk about your own patience if we've practiced patience along the way. So these are just things that are like healthy replacement beliefs, but they only become possible if, when things aren't as challenging, we practice those coping skills. Okay, so what I want to do now is just to sort of sum up the whole series. In fact, not only this series, but sum up the series in context of the whole mindfulness concept in general, and then share with you two additional ideas. So we talked about mindfulness being the practice of being aware, right? That's what, in its core essence, that's what mindfulness is. Being in the now, being able to maximize the full potential of every moment with purpose, with meaning. Being aware of what's happening in every present moment without judging that moment, meaning without taking the judgments of the past and the worries of the future, so to be able to give it the freshness of the moment. And as we talked about last time in great detail, that mindfulness from a Jewish perspective is also not just to be aware, but to be aware of the deeper layer of what we're experiencing. So not just what it appears to be on the surface, but what it's really. For example, the concept of breathing, that when we breathe, it's not just being aware of our breath, which is a very important thing, but being aware of the neshama, which is the soul, which is coming through in the breath. When we talk about being aware of the taste of the food, it's also being aware of the gift that God has given us, the food, and so on and so forth. So that's what mindfulness is. And the hardest part of mindfulness is the non-judgmental, because the hardest part of mindfulness, as we've talked about, is letting go. Letting go of the distraction, particularly as we've talked about this series in great length, when we're going through a time which is very tough, which is very challenging, and we're being bombarded with all kinds of thinking patterns. When we go through times which, as we've said, Russ Harris calls the reality slap, where we're confronted with something, either something someone's done to us, or a real tragedy, or a real sense of pain, or whatever the event is, but it's something that's knocked us about, and therefore it leaves us with a kind of effect where we now walk around with a few weeks with a distraction, and hard to focus, hard to be aware, hard to experience the now. That's when we need to really engage in the strategy of being able to let go. So that's mindfulness in general. But then in this series, what we did was, just to sum it up, we talked about a number of things that are so important to do that. The first is, just to summarize, the first is sort of the idea of having a purpose. In order to become present, we have to have a purpose in the present. Understanding that every moment, every day, is the idea of a life that we've been given to experience every moment with some meaning and purpose. It's interesting, just last night, and you know, and I'll come back to it towards the end as well, but there's a definite link between the concept of mindfulness and the concept of happiness. Last night I just finished a series on happiness, and we talked about the real concept of happiness, and happiness meaning not just pleasure and having a good time, but happiness from the sense of having an inner sense of fulfillment, an inner sense of satisfaction. And we know that there are various things that bring happiness. One of them, of course, is the concept of setting goals, having goals based on values. There's research out that when a person who sets goals, that person has a value system, and they set goals, they set a destination, they set what they focused on based on those values, that brings happiness at a greater level. And the reason for that is because when you have a goal, then every day, whatever the experience is, no matter what we're experiencing, we're focused on the goal, and therefore we're able to find meaning and purpose in every experience and be focused on every experience based on our value system. In other words, if we have no value system, if we have no goals, then every day is just haphazard and just ad hoc, then when things don't go well, that we're frustrated and we're aimless and we're meaningless and we just don't have a direction, and we experience a deep sense of emptiness. But when we have that goal, where we have a driven goal to understand where we're going in life, what our mission is, like Steve Covey, we've talked about this before. Steve Covey, one of his main seven habits is this idea of begin with the end in mind. Have a mission statement that's based on values, a value-based system. Because when we do that, then it makes it much easier to focus on the moment, because what is happening at the moment is only superficial, but if I know what my goal is, I can make that happen now in any experience. I can be focused on the now to be able to find meaning and purpose. And I just shared a story. I'll share it with you as well. This concept of having a purpose and having goals. There was a great... I'm trying to think. No one was there last night, right? No. I'd like to be repetitive, but this is worth sharing. This is a very beautiful idea. There was a great chassid who I knew, I admit, I didn't know him well, but I knew him because I knew him when he was really very old. And his name was Reb Mendel Futterfuss. That was he was from Russia. Now, just to give you a bit of context, he was a great, a very, very famous Hasidic Jew. He did, just to give it a bit of context, he was from Russia, and he grew up in the time of under communist regime. Now, if you understand a little bit about the communist regime after the Russian Revolution, they were bent on destroying Yiddishkeit, or destroying any form of Jewish faith, Jewish observance. Those who remained committed to Judaism had to go underground in order to establish underground places of learning. It was illegal to learn Torah and Judaism and so on and so forth. They wanted to eradicate Shabbat. Everything, it was a terrible time. And it was dangerous. And people used to get caught and sent to Siberia. People would be killed. There were many great Hasidim in Russia who were killed because of that, and so on and so forth. After the war, there was a window of opportunity that the Russians, you couldn't get out of Russia, that was a part of the problem. And there was a window of opportunity that the Russians said that anyone who has a Polish passport, because they were displaced during the war, would be able to leave Russia. And once you left Russia, even in Poland, although it was also communist, it was easier to escape to other places. So he and a number of his friends launched into a whole illegal, it was dangerous, they had to do it, a false passport thing, where they produced false Polish passports and quite a number of people were able to leave Russia at that time. He had an opportunity himself to leave a number of times, and he said he wouldn't do it as long as there's other people who he can help leave. He's not going. He sent his family out. His family landed up in England eventually, but he didn't go. Towards the end, this whole thing ran out, and the Russia started to catch on to it, and there was like the last few moments that it was possible. So he had one or two passports that were left, and one or two of his friends, they decided, okay, there's nothing left to do here. We'll try and escape, and he got caught. He got sent to a Siberian hard labor camp for 8 years. He was sentenced for 8 years. Now, anyone who knows anything about the Siberian prison system, most people didn't come back alive, or if they came back alive, they were a skeleton and a mere emotionally messed up. Not Remendel. Remendel was a very, very strong person. He came out of Siberia after 8 years. He moved to a place in Russia for a number of years, and he still couldn't get out, and eventually he made it out, and he was reunited with his family in England. A couple of months after he arrived in England, he had already lost a child in Russia, by the way, and a couple of months after he arrived in England, he had a tragedy that his daughter got killed in a car accident. His married daughter got killed in a car accident. Their family all over the world, in fact, in Melbourne, one of her sons lives there. Now, why am I telling you this? If you would have met this Reb Mendel Futterfuss, he was like this. If you talk about happiness and mindfulness and being focused every moment on what the mission is, this was the symbol of it. If you meet him, it like was contagious. He had this inner sense of glow and satisfaction and inner happiness every time, all the time. And when you met him, you think this is like the happiest person in the world. You would never guess, if you didn't know, that he'd suffered at all in his life. Like, you'd never guess at all. He just was always positive, always with a smile. His way of greeting someone, and he would talk about this sometimes. He would talk about what he used to call in Yiddish, avarim shalom aleichem, like a warm hello, not just hello because it's a nice thing to do and you're being polite, but like when he would greet someone, it would be with a connection. It would be really, you know, he was the most amazing, amazing person. I'm telling you all of this because of what I said before about having purpose and having goals. Someone once asked him, how did he survive the 8 years in the Siberian prison, labor camp? So he told the following story. He said one of the things was the following. He said that early on, there was one day where I think it was a public holiday or something, and the officers were kind of more relaxed and they weren't as tight and they weren't supervising, and a bunch of them were sitting around and had an opportunity to, him and other inmates who weren't Jewish, were just sitting there and having a schmooze. And they got talking about what they were doing before they landed up in prison. So one particular guy, he was asked, what did you do? He said, I worked for the circus, and my job was I was a tightrope walker. Okay, it's very nice, tightrope walker. So all of a sudden, the guy say, why don't you give us a bit of a demonstration? If we can find a piece of string, give us a bit of a thing. So he did. So Reb Mendel said that he had made up that every day he would always think about how he could make the day purposeful, no matter where he was. And he would always try and practice the teaching of the Baal Shem Tov, that whatever you see and hear, you'd always have to learn a lesson. So he was thinking, what kind of lesson can he learn from this? So he went over to the guy, just a Russian regular guy, and he said to him, how does it work? How do you do this tightrope walking? So the guy says, it's very simple. When you go on a rope, when you walk on the rope, the most important thing is don't look right or left, focus on the end. Focus on the destination. And Remendel said he lived with that his whole life. That was his every day, no matter what the situation was, no matter what the experience was, he was always focused, what's my goal in life? What's my purpose? And that's what got him through. And just it didn't just get him through, but he was a person that no matter what he experienced, and he wasn't naive, by the way. He wasn't in denial. He didn't look at the world through rose-colored glasses. He understood. He was a very, very intelligent man. Very, very intelligent man, in fact. And he knew exactly what the situation was, and he understood his suffering very well. And nevertheless, he just rose above it in the most incredible way. And he stayed focused. So one of the concepts of engaging with distraction and engaging with things that come and confront us and stand in the way of us being focused and really trying to get everything we can out of the day and out of the moment and out of the experience is having goals and having purpose, having a sense of meaning and purpose. Just before I go on, I'll just tell you an interesting story with him, because there's nothing to do with what we're talking about. But the one time that he was very down in Russia, he was a chassid, he was a follower of the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe. And there was one time that he was down. He was missing his family, and he was upset that he was down, but he was down and he sort of couldn't lift himself up. There was one day, and he, at that moment, he sat down and he thought about something. He said he thought about something he'd once heard from the previous Rebbe, that a chassid and a Rebbe can have a connection, and sometimes the connection can be via thought. So he sat down and he tried to connect to his Rebbe, which was the previous Rebbe, and he kind of, in his thoughts, he sent him a letter and he asked him for a blessing. Couldn't send a telegram, couldn't send anything. And the previous Rebbe, by then, was already in America. Eventually, when he got out, it was after the previous Rebbe had already passed away. And he came to England, and he was reunited with his family. And his wife was telling him about that through the years that they were in England, the previous Rebbe had communicated to them often, sent them letters, and found out how they were and how they're doing and so on and so forth. But his wife said, there's one letter which is very puzzling, because there's one letter that came that was addressed to you. And it said that I received your request for a blessing and I'm giving you a blessing. And he says, what do you mean? I never sent any letters to the previous Rebbe. So I said, well, I don't know. That's the story. I'll show you the letter. And showed him the letter, and he looked at the date and he flashed back to that time. It was the same day that he'd connected via thought to the previous Rebbe, and the previous Rebbe responded, a fascinating thing. But that was really the only time that he actually felt he wanted to despair a little bit, and then he picked himself up again. Amazing person. So that's the concept of having purpose. Even though we understand the struggle, and we talked about this a lot over the last few weeks, that we have a struggle, and the struggle is there by design, but it's there for us to use our focus, use our purpose, and overcome that struggle and become a stronger person. The second thing we talked about was, just to sum up, is we talked about the idea to understand that we have those thought patterns which invade us and stand in the way, to understand that it's not us. But to use the analogy of the passengers, they're just passengers in the bus distracting the driver. And then we talked about the strategies, which, depending on the situation, either we challenge the beliefs, we challenge our thoughts by challenging the belief system, or we ignore them completely. And also we talked about the power of action, the power of engaging in good things to take us away from the distraction of those thoughts. And then last week, again, we talked about the concept of strengthening the muscle. And one thing we also highlight, and I want to just highlight again, is that to understand the success is not in finishing the job. The success is not in overcoming the thought patterns completely. The success is, we might not be like Reb Mendel. He was a very, very special person who managed somehow to do it all the time. We might not be able to be like that. And I've said before, the reason that we tell stories of great people is not to make us depressed and think, oh, I'll never be like that. It's to understand the goal. It's to understand what the goal is, and then to work towards it slowly. And we work towards it slowly, we're able to experience and celebrate success along the way. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is just go into two things. Because talking about mindfulness, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about the role of mindfulness, not just in the way we experience life every day, but the role of mindfulness in our relationships, which is a really, really important thing. And I'm doing this because I'm sharing with you something that I've taken from a book called The Seven Principles for Making Marriage Work. It's by John Gottman. Any of you know, if you know about his work, he's a fascinating guy. John Gottman, a Jewish fellow, is a guy who created what he calls a love lab, where he scientifically studies the success of relationships. Now, obviously, there's exceptions to every rule and so on and so forth. But what he did was, in his early work, he researched how relationships work and the predictability of good relationships. Right? And he would take couples and put them in an apartment for a couple of days, whatever, and during non-private time, during the day particularly, they would set up cameras, and he asked them to try and live as normally as possible, and he asked them to communicate, and he asked them if they have a disagreement, they should fight. They should have it out. And they did, and he developed a system of predicting the success of the marriage, like at some ridiculous success rate, like over 90%. He could tell if the marriage was going to last or not. Now, the purpose was not just to predict and then let them think. Eventually, he worked out a way how to fix it. That he'd identified what are the predictors of a healthy relationship or not, he then wrote a book, and wrote a number of books actually, to highlight what those issues were, and to encourage people. And then he would bring couples back and work with them to try and save and to nurture and develop the relationship. So in this book, it's called Seven Principles. He has seven basic principles to make a marriage work. But by the way, what I'm sharing with you is not only about a marriage, it's about all types of relationships, close relationships particularly. And he has a chapter there called Turning Towards Each Other. That's what it's called. And anyway, here's the book. That's what it's called. And he comes up with this idea. He said sometimes what he realized in observing couples, right, that it wasn't the moments of tremendous closeness or romance necessarily that would be predicting a good marriage or healthy relationships. But the way he calls it was the simple things that if you were writing a novel or making a movie, you'd cut it out and completely ignore it because it would be boring. And it wouldn't make good filming. Those are the things that were as important, or in his words, perhaps more important and more powerful than the moments of intense passion or intense romance. Not that those moments aren't important; they're very, very important. Love and romance and all those things in a marriage context, or moments of closeness in other relationships, are very, very important, because at the end of the day they create passion and they inject passion and they fuel the marriage. But on an ongoing basis, the moments, the small things, for example, in this particular chapter he calls it about being connecting and being mindful of what the other person is doing and being present. So he has this concept about turning towards each other. That if two people are sitting in a room and the husband comes in or the wife comes in and says something, and he or she happened to be reading a newspaper or something like that, right? The reaction is so important. In other words, that's why it's called turning towards each other. Does the person just sort of shrug it off and say, yeah, yeah, but really they're not there. They're actually in what they're doing. Or they actually pick up their head, physically turn, and actually turn towards the person, right? The physical turning towards the person is not it's not the physical action that's important. It's what it represents. So things like, I'll read you one. He says things like, our archives are filled with scenes in which the husband looks out of the picture window and says, wow, look at that boat, right? And the wife looks up and looks to him and says, yeah, and looks at the thing and says, yes, it looks like that big thing that we went last summer. In other words, connection. I notice, I'm here, I'm present, I understand what you're saying, I'm listening to you, and I'm connecting, right? So that's the concept that he talks about, and that's something perhaps that doesn't happen enough. And I think today, and I've said this many times, but it's true with this as well, I think today what's happening is that particularly technology is really ruining this part of relationships, where people are so absorbed in the things that are directing their attention that actually are not really paying enough attention to the relationships, to the other things, in small things, particularly in small things, right? And he has this great line where he says, couples often ignore each other's emotional needs out of mindlessness, not malice, right? We're not talking about a bad relationship. We're not talking about people who are being cruel. We're not talking about people who are being unkind. It's just they're not being mindful. They're not paying attention, right? If you're spending time with someone, you're spending time with someone. If you're listening to someone, you're listening to someone. And today we are so distracted that we don't do that. We pretend to listen often. We pretend to reply. We pretend to respond. And we're not really there. And I thought that was a really, really important to bring in, because if we're talking about the whole concept of mindfulness, mindfulness is not only important for ourselves to experience the now of every moment and to get the fullest out of every experience. Mindfulness is critically important, talking about relationships, how we talk to each other, how we pay attention to each other. In other words, if a person's busy and say, listen, I really can't talk to you now, I'm busy, that's fine. But if you're talking to someone or you're connecting with someone, you're either there or you're not there, right? And sometimes what people do is they're there, but they're not there. They're there, but very not mindfully, right? Without mindfulness, without actually fully connecting physically, first of all, turning towards, paying attention, making eye contact, listening. Listening means, as we've said before, and mindfulness means, as we said in the last few weeks, letting go of other stuff, which means either listening to me or you're checking your email. One of the two. Make up your mind, right? It's fine. If you want to check your email, that's okay. I'll talk to you when you finish. But don't talk to me and check your email at the same time or check your WhatsApp at the same time, because you're not doing either properly, right? I know multitasking is a skill apparently that some people have, but not men apparently. But nevertheless, multitasking is not good for it's good for efficiency, but it's not good for relationships, right? Because it doesn't bring that mindful focus. It doesn't bring that real sense of connecting and being there. And I think that's something which probably in most relationships today people need to reflect on. And need to think about, how mindful am I in the relationship? Not in designated moments of tremendous passion, but just regularly. Over lunch, at the house, when I'm sitting around, how mindful am I in connecting to the other person? That's just mindfulness in relationships, which I thought was a great chapter and a very, very important thing. So what I want to spend some time on now is talking about mindfulness, because everything happens by divine providence. But let's just bring back the mindfulness idea and connect it with the upcoming festival of Purim, which is this coming Sunday. First of all, we have Purim this Sunday, where we celebrate the salvation of the Jewish people between the first and second temple from the wicked Haman. And we know that Purim is known and designated as a day of tremendous happiness. As I said before, mindfulness and happiness have a direct link. And Purim has a number of components which are very, very much linked into the whole concept of mindful living and purposeful living. And I want to spend some time sort of sharing it with you. When we say Purim is about happiness, first of all, right? You've heard this from me before. We need to understand what the word happiness means, and it's therefore it's linked to mindfulness. Because happiness is not just about celebration. Happiness is not just about singing and dancing. Happiness is about an inner sense of satisfaction, inner sense of fulfillment, which comes from learning to find meaning in every experience. That's what happiness comes from. You all heard me say this before, and we talked about it in the night series, that often people confuse happiness and pleasure. So pleasure is an outside-in thing. Pleasure is something where I derive pleasure from something outside of me, which is not a bad thing as long as we're not obsessed with it, but it doesn't bring happiness. We know that, and today it's a researched fact, scientifically researched fact. They've done many, many, many studies, and particularly in the States, and they've found that once a person has their basic needs, there's absolutely no link between what people have and enjoy and the concept of happiness. Nothing. It doesn't mean that they're not happy, but it doesn't mean that they are happy. In other words, happiness comes from within. Happiness is an inside-out concept, right? And that comes from the idea of purpose. So we'll see how this is all linked to Purim in general. But one of the research studies out in the States talks about what does bring happiness, and they come up with the three Fs. What it is? Three Fs? I guess. Three Fs that bring happiness. Not food, by the way. Exactly. Family, friends, and faith. Quite amazing. Family, friends, and faith. Right? So relationships, connection, but family, friends, not just having a family, that's not good enough. It's connection to the family and connection to friends, right? and faith. And there's an amazing research about this, the faith component as well, that the idea of having a connection to something, having a purpose. So, as we said before about Remendel, having a destination, having something that you live for, a value system that you live for and are driven towards, actually brings a sense of purpose and therefore brings a sense of inner fulfillment, right? Now, when we talk about happiness, of course there is room and there is a role for undiluted, intense times of happiness. Because if we talk about happiness being an inside-out idea and a sense of inner fulfillment, that's a constant thing. That's not only in times of celebration. That's a thing which we should always be. Happiness is a constant thing. As we know, there's a verse that tells us, "Ivdu et Hashem b'simcha." We've got to serve God with joy. Serving God is something we do every day, all day, right? They tell a story that was once a Hasidic Rebbe on Tisha B'Av, which of course is the saddest day of the year. And Tisha B'Av is a day that we observe different laws of mourning to remember the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. For example, sitting on a low stool or wearing non-leather shoes or fasting or reading the passages of Eicha, which are sort of more tragic and sad. All these things are part of the customs of Tisha B'Av, and it's like similar to when a person sits Shiva, God forbid, and so on. So one particular Hasidic Rebbe, he was observing all the laws of Tisha B'Av. He was doing everything right. But he seemed to be doing it with quite a positive sort of happiness almost, right? And someone said to him, "Rabbi, I think you've mixed up the days. It's not Purim today, it's Tisha B'Av. Like, why do I detect this happiness on your face?" So he said very simply, he said, "Listen, I was trained like this." He says, observing Tisha B'Av is one of the mitzvot. It's one of the commandments that we have to do, all the customs of Tisha B'Av. So mourning for Jerusalem is a mitzvah, and I was always trained that every mitzvah you do with joy, right? But it's a very deep response, because joy doesn't necessarily mean what we always think joy means. Now, joy doesn't mean singing and dancing and celebrating. Joy means to be able to find meaning and purpose and inner fulfillment in everything that we do, which is why it's so linked to mindfulness. It's about every moment understanding the purpose and the value of that moment, so I can get the best out of that particular experience, right? Having said that, of course, however, there are times which we are designated for open celebration, like Purim. Purim, we don't do any of those mourning. Purim, we have to celebrate. Purim is a mitzvah to say a bit of an extra l'chaim. Purim is a mitzvah to come together, have a meal, a festive meal, and to really celebrate. Why do we have those times? What role do they play? Or times of simchas, or times of yontif? These things are all times of real joy. Why? Because in order to understand the purpose of joy the entire year, every day of the year, we need to, as we spoke about last week, we need to strengthen the muscle of joy. So we have to have times where we have open joy, which then bring, hopefully, and inject a sense of joy into the rest of the year, so we're able to find joy in everything that we do. However, given the link between the moments of real joy and the rest of the year, even the moments of real joy are times of focused joy. In Judaism, we don't have this concept of just letting loose and escaping into joy. See, pleasure is something you escape into. When a person's very down and they've had a bad day and then they settle down for a coffee and a chocolate croissant, that's an escape, right? Okay? And sometimes it's okay. It's a good thing to do. If not worse than that, right? But that's okay. But so pleasure is something you escape into. Joy is never something you can escape into, because then it's not joy. Because the definition of joy is focused joy. The definition of joy is, even at times of completely unlimited, infinite, open happiness, it's always going to be with a focus. And in fact, in Jewish experience, we find a very fascinating thing. I don't know if you realize this. Every time we have joy in the Jewish cycle or Jewish experience, it's always preceded by something more reflective and something sort of a bit toned down to give us a focus. For example, Purim. So Purim, the day before Purim, or this year, a few days before Purim, today actually, is Tanit Esther, the fast day of Esther. It's funny, you have this unbelievable, joyous day of Purim, and the day before is a fast day. It almost sounds like disconnected. But no, it's not, because before we hit the actual day of Purim, we have a day of a fast day, not just to deprive ourselves, it's a day of reflection, right? A wedding reception, which is such a joyous occasion, is always preceded by a chuppah, which is much more of a serious event. Sukkot and Simchat Torah, which is considered the biblical festival of joy. In fact, in our prayers on those festivals, we say Zman Simchatenu. It's a time of our joy. That's the time that God says V'samachta b'chagecha. You should celebrate and eat and drink and really celebrate, but it's preceded by Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, which is the time of much, it's more reserved, it's the time of reflection, time of prayer, right? And so on and so forth. You'll find that all the times we have those concepts of celebration, always preceded by something which gives us a bit of a focus. Because as we enter into a time of tremendous joy, and if it's a time designated for open joy, we should go for it and really celebrate it properly, but we have to understand what the purpose of it is and what the meaning of it is. So I want to go through Purim a little bit and show you how, in fact, throughout Purim we have this concept. First of all, the story of the Megillah is a fascinating story. And if we talk about mindfulness, there's nothing greater than the Megillah to actually discuss this. One of the things of mindfulness is the art of noticing. Art of noticing. We talked about this a few weeks ago. The idea to learn to notice things, right? To be aware of what's happening. Now, Purim is actually, the reason why Purim is such a joyous festival is because Purim actually is the festival of noticing. Why do I say that? If you know the story of Purim, you know anything about the Megillah, which we listen to on Purim, it's a fascinating thing. It's so different to other festivals. Let's take Pesach, for example. The Jews left Egypt, right? There was 10 plagues that were given to the Egyptians before they left. When they left, they came to the Red Sea, and there was a splitting of the Red Sea. An open miracle, an absolutely open miracle. You have to be completely blind not to notice the hand of God in the story of Pesach, right? Story of Hanukkah even, right? Okay, they win the war. A war you can erroneously mistake as being the act of man. But when you come to the main story of Hanukkah, which is the miracle of the oil, you take a little jug of oil that's supposed to only last for one day and it lasts for 8 days. That's just a miracle. I mean, there's no other way to interpret it. It's an absolute miracle, right? Purim is very different. The story of Purim is not miraculous on the face of it. It's just a regular story. If you take the story of Purim, you will see that you could actually miss the hand of God. You could miss the gift of the Purim story. Because every event, it's 9-10 chapters, the Megillah. Every event you read about in the Megillah is not supernatural. There's no supernatural event. Ahasuerus had a party. At a party, he killed Vashti because he was a madman. He married Esther because he was looking for a new queen. He was a bit of a mishuganess, so he elevated Haman to be the prime minister. He was temperamental, so he got angry with Haman later. He couldn't sleep one night. Well, that's, I mean, I think we all suffer from that sometimes, right? So that's fine. Esther intervened. She made a party. She invited Haman and Ahasuerus. She took a chance. She tried to nail Haman at the party, and it worked, and he got killed, and the Jews were saved. Nothing supernatural about the story. However, it takes half an hour to read, but it took 12 years to happen. And if you understand the events of the Purim story and how every event happened when it happened, you see the most incredible puzzle coming together. That if everything wouldn't have happened exactly when it happened and how it happened and in the way that it happened, the whole story couldn't have happened. It wouldn't have been successful. So you see an incredible miracle if you look deeply, if you notice, if you look for it, right? And that's why it's such a time of happiness. See, happiness is not about, it's like all the things we talk about, happiness, gratitude, all these things. It's not about the big things. It's about noticing the small things. Just like gratitude, for example. The power of gratitude is not saying thank you to someone or say thank you to God when something absolutely unbelievable happens. It's about every morning saying thank you to God for waking up. Thanks, I got my soul back. I have shoes to put on. I have eyes that I can see. The things that we take for granted, the things that we forget are gifts. That's what mindfulness is. That's what noticing is. And Purim is the same thing. Purim is the day of the greatest joy because it's hard to notice. And because it's the gift of noticing those small things, the things that seem small, and that only when we look deeply, we notice them and we start to appreciate the greatness of their gift. In fact, what's interesting is, if you have a look at the Megillah that we read on Purim, right? Megillah. It's called Megillat Esther. Now, if you take apart those words in Hebrew, it's interesting. The word Esther comes from the Hebrew word lehastir, to hide, concealment. Right? The word Megillah comes from the Hebrew word legalot, to reveal. They're two opposite words. The word Megillat Esther are two opposite words. And that's the power of Purim. The power of Purim is to reveal that which is concealed, to notice the gifts and the small things that we often go unnoticed, to discover the greatness and the hand of God in a normal, natural course of events that don't seem to be special. That's what the power of Purim is. So if we talk about the lessons of mindfulness that are connected to Purim, this is the first and foremost one, the concept of being aware, learning to notice, or as to use the words of the mindfulness literature, paying attention on purpose. Right? Paying attention on purpose you do when you need to. You don't need to pay attention on purpose, something monumental happens. You need to pay attention on purpose when things are going, seem to be going in a normal, regular way. So that's the first lesson, which is so connected to what we've been talking. Secondly, we talk about the idea of purpose. We spoke before about the idea of purpose, right? Haman has two opposite, the Megillah has two opposite characters. The hero of Purim is Mordechai and the Jewish people. The villain of the Megillah is Haman, right? Haman was a person who had no purpose. He led a life of complete emptiness. Why? Because his entire purpose, if you could say he had a purpose, was himself. See, the definition of a purpose and having a goal in life and meaning and purpose and value is something outside of us, to pursue something greater than ourselves. That's why to lead a life of meaning and purpose, one needs to deal with the ego a little bit, because when we're egocentric, we remain trapped in who we are. We remain trapped in our own ego. We don't live a life of purpose. We live a life of satisfying the needs and the pleasure of our own existence. If we lead a life of meaning and purpose, we're able to go beyond ourselves. We're able to not think about ourselves so much, and we're able to rather pursue that which is greater than ourselves, right? That's what living a life of values means. Haman didn't live a life of values, he lived a life that was empty. And the proof of that is something I've shared many, many times, but it's one of the most powerful, for me, one of the most powerful, powerful sentences of the Megillah. When Haman comes home and he tells his wife the following. It was after he had been elevated to the highest position in the country, and he'd become the prime minister, and he was invited to an exclusive banquet with Ahasuerus and Esther, the one night. And then he was invited the second night again, and he comes out and he's on top of the world. In fact, the word sameach is used, happy, but it's a happiness in a different way. Negative happiness. Why? And he comes out of the palace, and suddenly he remembers that, oh, there's Mordechai sitting here, and he doesn't want to bow down to me, right? And he gets very, very upset. He's got everything. The whole nation is bowing down to him, but there's one old Jew that refuses to bow down to him, and he gets upset. And he comes home, and this is the most bizarre verse in the Megillah. And he calls a family meeting. And the Megillah says, he relates to his family, I've been elevated, I'm rich, I'm wealthy, everyone's bowing down to me. And then he says, I've even been invited to a banquet with the queen and the king, only me, tonight, and I'm being invited again tomorrow. And then he says the following words. Listen to how a madman thinks. Although, in a subtle way, we often do this ourselves as well. That's why it's such an important lesson. He says, V'chol ze einenu shoveli. All of this is worth nothing to me, as long as I see Mordechai the Jew who refuses to bow down to me. All of this. Can you imagine? He's got so much. He's got everything everyone could wish for, supposedly, presumably. And he says, it's worth nothing. Not that I'm a little bit upset, but I'll get over it in 5 minutes when I remember the greatness that I have. He says, no, v'chol ze einenu shoveli, all this is worth nothing to me. Because my ego was punctured. Because it's all about me. Because it's not about purpose, it's not about value, it's not about a journey, it's not about finding meaning and purpose in anything, it's about me. And therefore, as soon as the me gets threatened, even by one old guy that's sitting there at the palace who refuses to bow down to me, the rest is worth nothing. It's the most incredible, incredible thing. But if you think about it, how many times do we sometimes fall into the same trap? Where we have a mission in life, we have so much to do, life is so short, we've got so much that we need to engage in that is valuable and meaningful, and sometimes we get just so caught up and entangled in the stupidities of something that someone said or that someone did or something that happened. And on a subtle way, obviously not as bad as Haman, but in a very subtle way, we kind of sort of do the same thing. We're not stupid enough to go tell someone that, but so we keep it to ourselves maybe, but nevertheless, we kind of, you know, but that's what we have to learn from the Megillah, because the Megillah is the other time that it says the word happiness in the Megillah is when the Jews were saved. But actually, the way the story goes, we don't have time now to go into great detail, but we've done it before. When they were saved, they weren't out of the woods yet. It was still a war to fight, they were under a lot of threat, and yet they were happy. Why? Because part of the Megillah story was that they connected to their purpose. They reconnected to God. They had lost the way a little bit. They fasted, they prayed. They had learned to reconnect and find purpose in their lives, and suddenly, la yudim haita simcha, they were full of joy. So that's another very, very strong link to the whole concept that we've been talking about, because mindfulness is actually being able to focus on every experience and understand the gifts that we have, understand the gift of every moment, being aware of that, and part of that is through understanding the purpose of life, which is so clear in the Megillah. And then just generally, the whole story of Purim, and this is just linked to the whole concept of mindfulness and happiness in general, the way the Purim day actually plays out is quite amazing. The first thing we do on Purim is we read the Megillah. That's one of the mitzvot of Purim. Because before we engage in a day of tremendous happiness, we have to understand what the purpose of it is. And therefore we read the Megillah, which is the book of values. It's the art of noticing, understanding, and appreciating the hand of God in everything. And then a large part of Purim is spent on mitzvot of giving and connecting to others. Because before we actually sit down on the Purim afternoon to a festive meal, the mitzvah of Purim is to give mishlach manot matanot la'avyanim. Mishlach manot is the mitzvah of Purim to give at least one package of two edible foods to a friend, and then to give one gift to two needy people, right? Matanot la'avyanim, to help those that are in need. An important mitzvah. Why? Because you can't have joy, true joy, which is the equivalent of finding meaning and purpose, you cannot have that if we trapped in ourselves. Joy comes from giving. When we caught up with ourselves, and we talked about this a few weeks ago as well, one of the antidotes to the distractions and the obsessions and the things that stand in the way for us finding meaning and purpose in every moment is to launch into action and to give. And that's why Purim, because it's a day of happiness and because it's a day where we try and learn this lesson of being fully present and finding fulfillment and joy in everything that we do, even beyond Purim, how do we create that formula, how do we create that model? By giving to others, giving to family, friends, which is Mishlach Manot, and giving to those who we might not even know, which is helping other people that are in need, because that's what brings true happiness, that's what connects us to others, that's what allows us to go beyond ourselves, to lose our ego, and to focus on what is really valuable and very, very important. And then after that, then towards Purim afternoon, the Shulchan Aruch says that then when you finish giving to others and you finish hearing the Megillah, then you sit down to a real festive meal, because then the festive meal, the celebrations, the festivities have focus, have meaning, have purpose, because it comes with having helped others, understanding what the real value of life is. It's not just about pleasure, but it's about helping and giving and living a higher purpose. Then we're able to really celebrate and say L'chaim and really have a Seudah, which is also one of the mitzvot of Purim, to have that festive meal with others and to celebrate the happiness of Purim. So I just thought we'd share that, because since the Sunday is Purim, I thought it'd be good just to link that with some of the concepts we've been talking about. So just to end off, just two announcements I want to make. First of all, talking about Purim, it would be, if one can, it would be lovely to sort of engage in the mitzvot of Purim. As they do in many, many shuls and institutions, there are many, many times that the Megillah is being read. I sent out an email this week, so if you're interested in coming to hear the Megillah, just check the email and have a real, really Purim Sameach. As again, I'll be away the next few weeks, but we will have one before Pesach on the 30th of March called Life Changing Lessons from the Seder Plate. The new series next term starts 27th of April. Have a Purim Sameach, a wonderful week. I'll see you when I get back.